Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide.
Good morning and welcome to Talkback Gardening. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Deb, and good morning, gardeners, particularly if you've got a lawn and your lawn is in trouble at the moment. It would appear from our feedback from lawn texts and emails that we're getting the lawns are in a bit of trouble, and so I thought maybe we need to talk to Stefan Palm, who's our turf consultant here in Adelaide. The question then comes to how often should you water the lawn, and when we do get a heat wave and we've browned the lawn off and it's gone into a quiescent period and we get a heat wave, will it recover? They're the issues that we're going to pose to Stefan Palm, but you might have your own particular questions.
Exactly. So if you've got a stressed lawn that needs restoring, or if you've just got a general lawn question, now is your time to ask. The phone number to call in on is 1300 222 891. We love your comments, but if you've got a question, call in. Stefan and John will be here to answer them on 1300 222 891. On lawns at the moment, and if you'd like to make a comment on the text line, the number is 0467 922 891. And later in the program, John will be talking about grassroots grants.
Yes. Adelaide is to become a cooler and greener and wilder city. And to make that happen, Green Adelaide, responsible for trying to achieve those greener and wilder and cooler conditions, they want to get the community involved. And they have provided a community grant of $1.2 million. Chairman of Green Adelaide, Chris Daniels, will join the program talking about the kind of projects they're looking for and maybe giving you some ideas so you can tap into that $1.2 million and help make Adelaide a greener and cooler and wilder city.
Wonderful. So stay tuned for that. And I have a couple of ABC Gardening Australia magazines to give away as well. But right now we want your lawn calls, 1300 222 891, and we want them because we've got our guest Stefan Palm with us, and we had a lot of days without rain. We had a little rain event, but it wasn't really enough.
Well, a couple of millimetres has disappeared probably before it even hit the ground, I suspect. So the question is, after 8 weeks of complete dryness and then a full fair dinkum heat wave about 2 weeks ago, it's really, let's take a look at how has that affected the lawn. Stefan Palm.
Morning, John. Morning, Deb.
Morning, Stefan.
Yeah, it had a quite profound effect on lawns. We noticed that people that looked after their lawns by way of water and fertiliser found that they had a bit of a growth surge, like a boom, and may have been having to be out there mowing a bit more often than they expected. But by far the majority of people, water moisture became a bit of a problem, where soils, as you would expect, dried out. And of course then lawns such as couches and kikuris and buffaloes, which is most people, you found that they browned down, they dried down. And then you're left in this condition, I guess, where we are now, where we've got persisting dry conditions and the lawns are sitting in that kind of dry state.
Gary, the gardener who looks after lawns in my area, I don't have a lawn, but there are certainly still plenty of lawns out there. And his observation is that those that have browned off their lawns, particularly with kikuyu and couch, there's nothing there. That was so hot that it actually burnt the root system. And he's saying, I think they might have to re-sow. Is it possible that they might recover?
Yeah, look, most lawns will in that category, especially couches and kikuyus. They go into what's called a drought-induced dormancy, which is where they do dry down and they do look dead. They can look very dead, but you'll find that once we get the autumn rains and the cooler, milder temperatures, they can tend to re-establish and green up again by themselves with little interaction from us.
So when they do recover, there are a lot of other little green things called weeds,
yeah,
that are probably filled in the spaces.
Yep.
The concept of browning off your lawn during summer as a means of saving water and then hoping that when we get autumn rains, they come early and the lawn will recover. What's the results or the effect of that on a lawn from a long-term point of view?
Look, they will persist. It depends what you want to do with it as to whether that's going to be okay for you or not. The lawn, you know, will never be as healthy as it could by doing that. You do, it does take a bit of effort from the grass to have to cycle like that. it will recover. I mean, take a walk down your neighbourhood during the summer months, you'll see a whole lot of brown lawns. Do the same thing in late autumn; those same lawns will have greened up. So in that sense, they will be okay. But if your purpose for having a lawn is for a nice green, cool, like you said before, amenity space in your backyard, then of course that's not going to be a good result.
Let's take a look at how often you should water the lawn. A question often posed, and it's very easy to say, well, it all depends,
yep.
And give them five reasons why you can't give them the right answer. And you have developed a little system, a simple little guide to give your customers an idea of just how often and how much. So let's take a look at, we can't do all the different kind of watering systems. That's probably the two most popular ones would be, say, a sprinkler on the end of a hose which gets moved around,
yep.
And maybe pop-up sprinklers. And those pop-up sprinklers, there's two different types. We might separate the two different types. But say a hose with a sprinkler on the end of it, how often and how much?
Yeah, good question. And there is a lot of yeah buts and depends and all that sort of stuff that come along with that. But the magic number, if you want a lawn that's good, that you're not being excessive with water, but you're not being, you know, underdoing it either. The magic number is 25 millimetres per week for couch and kaikuyu. And most people, when you say that number, what does that mean? How do I make that work for me? And so then that comes down to the question that you asked just then. With a sprinkler on the end of a hose, kind of like those old round metal ones that are still pretty popular, about kind of half an hour on one of them would do that per spot. So you have to move it around, of course, to make it move or cover your lawn, but that's about right for that.
Okay, so that's a guide. Half an hour for one of those sprinklers with a hole in the middle, and I won't ask you to give your views on the efficiency of those,
yep.
But let's take a look at the pop-ups. Now, you suggested to me in our discussions a few days ago that it's important to separate the different types of pop-ups.
Mm. Yeah, different pop-ups water at different rates, and so there's a water-efficient type sprinkler called a mini rotator that are quite popular now, and they go around in circles and send out little streams of water. And those ones water really slowly. In fact, to get 25 mil of water out in each zone, they only water at about 12 mil an hour. So you're really talking 2 hours, which seems like, wow, can I even do that? It'll mess with my head. But to get 25 mil of water out, that's what you're talking.
So putting on, if you've got one of the newer pop-up sprinklers, 2 hours, you leave it on.
Mm.
That's per zone.
Per zone.
Presumably, yep. If you've got a large lawn, you've got different zones. So 2 hours for a particular zone, then
that depends on how the sprinkler system's been set up. So most sprinkler systems are set to kind of water twice per area, if you like. They kind of cross over each other, and in that sense, you can cut that back to an hour per zone. So to make that simple, to make that translate to something that you can get for your sprinkler type in your area, you can get little catch cups, they're little rain gauges, if you like, that you can kind of dot around in your lawn, and you can turn your sprinkler system on and you can tell how long it takes to get that amount of water out, and that'll give you a good guide, and that takes into account your water pressure and your water flow and your sprinkler type and all those things.
All right, and that amount of water needs to be 25 millimetres in those little cups.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the ones, the newer ones, pop-up sprinklers, that are probably slower and more efficient in terms of their distribution, but
yep.
There are many people still got the old-fashioned pop-ups that just pop up and they've been there for yonks.
Yep.
And how long would you leave one of those on?
45 minutes to an hour.
45.
Mm. Yep.
So, Deb, I think we need to encourage people to come in with some questions.
We certainly do. If you would like to speak to Stefan Palm, we've got him until 9 o'clock this morning. Now is the time to call 1-300-222-891. Let's go to Jess from McGill, who has done just that. Welcome, Jess.
G'day, Deb. Hi, guys. I've had a lawn installed 1 year ago. It's really patchy and poor quality. I was thinking about getting a couple of bags of lawn soil to spread through the unevenness of it. And I've been applying a wetting agent, a Sisal wetting agent, every kind of second week. And I certainly haven't been watering it for 45 minutes to 2 hours. Is that every second day or once a week?
Just that number is once a week. And, you know, people choose to split that up between, you know, two waterings instead of one. And, of course, then you do the maths and work it back from there. But the goal is, in the end, to get it down to get water down to about 50 mil below the soil, below the surface. And so that requires getting, you know, to get a little hand trowel out maybe even and dig a hole after you've, or just get access to the soil once you've done a water and have a look and see how deep you got. Now, with your wetting agents, that's really good. That's ideal. And so all the water that you put on would be being drawn deeper into the soil. But just to get an idea of how deep that got down, you have a look. You'd be surprised at what you find. Often people will water for this amount of time and then go out and have a look at their lawn and go, gee, it looks like it needs a drink. And you scratch the surface and you go, it's bone dry. And you go, how is that even possible? But that's the nature of soil and its receptiveness to water as well.
You mentioned that seeing is believing, and the only way, or not the only way, the best way is to get a trowel and dig a little hole. How far should that water go? Did you say 50 millimetres?
Yeah, at least 50 mil. And
5 centimetres.
Yeah, the story is always told in the soil, or mostly always in those sort of circumstances. You'd be surprised at with very little knowledge about what you can actually tell by looking at that soil profile once you've done a water to see where it went.
Fantastic. Thank you for the call, Jess. Good luck with that. Nikki is in Millswood. You've got a sad lawn too, Nikki. Good morning.
Good morning to you all. Yes, I do. I've had a lovely lawn for many years. Trees have grown up and we've got a lot of shade. So last year I got a lot of the winter grass. So I've been to ask about it, and I am a bit concerned about the poison that's required to kill it, as we have a puppy. And it's a certain big area to kill. I'm wondering if it'd be easier if we got a shovel and, you know, took the top layer off and lay new lawn on top of that. Would that be better?
It depends.
I'm concerned about the poison.
Yeah. Look, it depends on lots of things there, like what type of grass you've got. If you've got trees that have matured over time and creating more shade, you may have a lawn there that doesn't like the shade, and that's causing some problems.
We do.
Yeah, and that introducing some new lawn into that would be ideal. Some more shade tolerant lawn. But you raise an interesting topic with those chemicals and how do you treat winter grass, because it is a prime time now to be treating winter grass, even though the winter grass isn't there yet. The chemicals that you would use, they are chemicals. There's one called Spartan, which you can use. And that one is a what's called a pre-emergent herbicide. And so that's, you put it on the soil surface and you water it in. You literally water it in straight away off the surface into the soil profile, because it's meant to act on the seeds that are either on the surface or just under it. And so in that sense, there's no contact with your pets or anyone else for that matter. The chemical itself is an unscheduled chemical. So as far as its toxicity goes, it's not particular. I mean, it's still a chemical. And you still need to apply caution and do it as recommended on the label. But as far as toxicity goes, it's not as high as you might think.
On that particular one, the whole concept there is you've got to put the chemical on before it rains and before the lawn's winter grasses, the seeds actually start to germinate.
Yep.
Now, given the fact that it's going to be the middle of May before we get a decent rain, should you put your winter grass chemical on now or wait a few weeks?
Look, you can. It lasts for 16 weeks in the soil, Spartan, so you could put it on now and you'll get coverage from the moment you put it on through to that kind of 16-week time frame, which you'd need to apply it again. So you're always going to put it on twice through the winter. You could put it on now and then do it again 16 weeks later. The only thing you're going to gain by waiting a few weeks is you'll delay it on the other end. You won't have to put it on, you know, 2 weeks earlier, I guess, in that sense, yeah.
Great. Our special guest in the studio is Stefan Palm, turf consultant. Thank you, Nikki, for your phone call. If you would like to grab Stefan in the few minutes we've got until 9 o'clock, now is the time to call on 1300 222 891.
This is Talkback Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe
on ABC Radio Adelaide.
Our special guest in the studio is Stefan Palm, turf consultant.
Stefan, the issue of water running over the surface and not running into and soaking the lawn roots, that probably needs a bit of expansion. It would appear to be probably one of the bigger problems out there at the moment.
Yeah, definitely. Water repellency is very misunderstood, I suppose, and underrated, even ignored. It's a problem with the soil where the soil just simply repels water like water on wax. And so you put your water on, and you know we've had people come into to the shop, or we've talked to them out on site, but they're saying, I'm watering every day. And then you look at the soil and it's bone dry, and you put water on it and it sits on there like, and it beads up and you get no penetration. And so with that, you can't get the water down, and because you can't get the water down, the roots don't go down deep. And because the roots don't go down deep, the lawn's shallow rooted and then reacts to these heat waves really quickly. And then because you can't get water down, you can't get nutrient down either. So you've got this cycle going on where your lawn just can't get itself sorted out and is constantly dry, even though you're watering it, and watering it more doesn't solve the problem.
So there are water repellent materials that you can actually water or get into the soil. So first of all, just explain the difference between a granule and probably a liquid. And then how do you actually get it into the soil if your soil is already water repellent?
Yeah, look, granules are more for soils that absorb water quickly and dry out quickly, like sands. Beach sand is a good example of that, goes through, straight through. Liquids help water repellent soils where the water doesn't get in quicker. So that's where you want to be. Non-water repellent soils, use liquid wetting agents.
We have lots of phone calls for Stefan Palmer. How many we're going to get through, we will try and get through as many as we can. Melissa is in Gawler. Welcome, Melissa.
Oh, hi. Thanks, Stefan. I've got I put in a tall fescue grass, like a seeded area, and put the subterranean watering in. It's hard to tell when it's getting enough water, unless you wait until all the water comes to the top or the edges of the grass.
Yep.
It's struggling, and I think, is it a better grass in winter than it is summer? Like, am I worried about it struggling now, and will it come back in the cooler in times?
Yeah, tall fescue is one of those grasses that doesn't cycle. Once it's gone, it's gone. It doesn't have any runners to regenerate with, so if you're finding that it's looking poor, you have to reseed it. It doesn't regenerate by itself, so in that sense, yeah, it is hard to tell underground drip zones or drip sprinkler systems with those types of lawns. It's just difficult.
You can't get those cups out that you were talking about to measure the amount of water.
Dig around, yeah. Yep.
Bit of investigative work there, Melissa. Thanks for the call. Shauna is on the line from McGill. Hi, Shauna.
Good morning, Deb, Stefan, John. My question is, you were just talking about the soil wetter for the lawn, and I'm putting that on. That says to do that every 2 weeks until the soil improves, so that's all good. But I'm wondering, can I also put the seaweed solution for the lawn on in the opposite weeks, or is that just not worth doing?
No, absolutely. They're two very different things, and so you don't need to be concerned about that. You can't substitute seaweed type products for fertilizer, just to keep that in mind. They're very good for stimulating root activity and for giving durability and to grasses vigor, but they don't have nutrient in them, so you need to combine that with your nutrient program as well.
Thanks, Shauna. Greg has called from Hindmarsh Island. Hi, Greg.
Oh, hello, folks. Look, I'm about to plant instant lawn, a cooch, Santa Ana, and I'm putting it on I'm yet to put the soil down, but an 80-20 mix of sand loam. My question is, do I put a pelletized fertilizer underneath the instant lawn before I lay it, or do I put a sea salt spread on it after I've laid it?
You can use fertilizer. You can use fertilizer and sea salt, but I wouldn't use just sea salt. Once again, just backing on the following up on the other question, but the underneath is ideal. You can definitely put it on top as well. Just a good organic blend, so nothing mineral and nothing too strong. Underneath is preferable, but either will do.
Thanks, Greg. Stuart's in Dernan Court with a Kaikuyu question. Hi, Stuart.
Yes, good morning, Deb, John, and Stefan. I've bought a square of Kaikuyu, which I want to fill in a bare patch on the lawn. How small can I cut the pieces into, and how far apart should I plant them?
Now, this is a question I haven't had for probably a good 15 years, I don't reckon. But when you buy a square of grass like that, it's better to cut into small cubes, probably kind of 50 millimetres, 5 centimetres would be the smallest you get it down to, and plant them closer together rather than cutting big pieces and planting them further apart, because the distance that the runner has got to spread will determine how quickly you get coverage. So small pieces close together are better than bigger pieces further apart.
So how close together?
30 centimetres would be
30
ideal.
30 centimetres, yep. Okay.
Thanks very much, Stuart. Appreciate that.
So let's take a look at some of the other issues that are worrying gardeners at the moment. And probably, I suspect, there are beetles out there, lawn beetles.
It's funny you should say that. We're getting a few texts, including Nancy saying we're having a lot of trouble with black beetle. Right. Yeah, a few texters have got beetle problems.
All right, and I suppose over time we've come to discover that probably it's more important to control the grubs than the beetles, but you also need to be able to control the beetles. Could you just give us an idea of very briefly, the life cycle? There's the beetles at some stage, and they do damage, but not as much as the grubs. When are the grubs there, and when are they doing damage? And when's the best time to try and control them?
yeah, for sure. Beetles around at the moment. There is definitely a lot of them around, and a lot of people are talking about them. And when I say beetles, I mean the adult black beetle. Even things like crickets and mole crickets and other things like that. Those types of insects are loving the conditions right now, and people are seeing a lot of them. But they're actually not doing a heap of damage themselves. I mean, if you had plague proportions of them, perhaps. But generally speaking, they're sitting in there now and getting ready for winter. They're going to sit there all winter, and then they're going to lay some eggs in your lawn, and that's where the problem starts. That happens around early spring, and so getting into your lawn and controlling those grubs is the critical thing. You can treat the beetles now, and that's fine, but and that's probably not a bad idea. You'll certainly get less egg hatch come spring if you don't have the beetles in there now, so that's a good idea. But the cycle will go, those adults will then sit in your lawn all winter. And then they'll lay their eggs. The eggs will hatch. The larvae will eat your lawn quite happily for right the way through summer. And you'll wonder what happened to your root zone. So treating in September for the grub is the most important.
I think we can sneak one more call in. Mary in Stirling, you've got a weed problem just like me. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning. Good morning, all. I just have a bigger nutweed problem in my front lawn, particularly. So I used to pull it out, but it's got out of hand. Sorry.
Yeah, nutgrass is a difficult weed to get on top of because it has a bulb underneath it, and that tuber or bulb wants to persist. So you pull it out the top, doesn't really make a lot of difference to the weed. It just continues to spread. So there are specialist products that you can get to control nutgrass in certain types of lawn. Like if you get it in kikuyu, it gets difficult. If you get it in grasses like tall fescue, it gets difficult. But you can get them for couches particularly.
Great. Thanks, Mary. I appreciate that. And just a comment from Andrew in Hope Valley says, my thick green carpet of Sir Walter Buffalo was envied by the neighbours, but it was fully thatched underneath. I nervously scalped it 2 months ago. Never done it. It was scary, but worth it. I think I timed it well based on the information from this show. It's all coming back again in time to stay nice all winter, but don't do it now, too late. Is Andrew right with that?
100%. Don't scalp your buffalo now. It is a bit sensitive with that, and it's got a going to go into dormancy probably middle of next month, which is not enough time to get a recovery.
Those lawns that have gone berserk because it's hot and they've been watering the lawns fairly well, and so you've got this excessive growth. Just a quick comment on how to manage that.
Yeah, ideally you want to get that out, but now it's sketchy about whether or not you'd have enough time to get a recovery. You'll get mostly a recovery, but perhaps not a complete one. So if you want to be safe, tackle it in October, cut it down to the ground, get the thatch out. And the cooch and kikuyu, that is, not buffalo.
Yeah, that's right. And just lower the mower gently on very, very rank grass.
Yep.
Jenny in Prospect wants to know about barriers. Hi, Jenny.
Good morning, peoples. I have a wonderful lawn. It's beautiful, it's lush, it's green, and it's all through my garden beds. It's kikuyu. How far down do I have to dig a barrier to stop the lawn from getting into my garden beds?
You can't.
Kikuyu, you're fighting a losing battle right there, Jenny.
Kikuyu chases the water, so if your garden beds are moister, wetter than your lawn area is, you are going to get kikuyu in your garden beds.
It's a shocker. I spend a lot of my life trying to get it out of my plants.
Yep. And of course, you mentioned that word, that, that plants chase the water, whether it's a tree or whether it's a couch grass or a kikuyu, if it's wet. So if you don't want roots in a particular area, don't water that area.
Yeah, and look, you can manage kikuyu really well like that if you keep it watered as well as you keep your garden watered and keep the soil nice. It, your invasiveness goes down a lot.
Yeah. So, just quickly coming back to the beetles and the grubs, that there's the two alternatives there. There are, used to be these beetle bombs, dreadfully toxic kind of materials. There are probably safer materials out there to control. Could you just quickly comment on the type of chemicals available now?
Yeah, so the springtime one, you use a chemical and it's got in it a product called acelaprin. You can buy that from just about anywhere. The most common one for home garden use is a Yates product. It's called Grub Kill and Protect, I think. That'll last for 6 months in the soil. Do it once in October, you'll solve your problem. If you really need to go get the beetles out now, you can use a bifenthrin-based product to control those adult beetles.
Wonderful information from turf consultant Stefan Palm. Stefan provides a wonderful blog in the Good Gardening newsletter, and we know from the feedback there that it's the most widely blogged, read blog on a regular basis, so congratulations on that. And for people that want good lawn information, I think just tapping into it, because if it's topical, you can bet your boots Stefan is blogging about it.
Absolutely. You can get so much information out of it, Stefan. I do read it, even though I don't necessarily follow your advice.
Thanks, Deb.
I know you're doing hard work in Glenelg North, because Ria has sent through a gorgeous photo saying, my beautiful kikuyu lawn growing on sand in Glenelg North that Stefan has spent the last 18 months getting to grow. So thanks for that, Ria. Really appreciate it. But Sue in Bellevue Heights does say, can we raise the issue of letting go of our obsession with lawns? We've got to get rid of some of that and go a bit more green and leave room for food. I guess it's a balancing act, isn't it?
It is, and it depends what you want. And there are, you know, there's lots of advantages of lawns on cooling and on you know, fire protection and on just what you want, like space to, you know, move and enjoy life and things like that. But yeah, there is the tension of other uses for those spaces.
It's an ongoing issue, and I think it's a debate we've had on Talkback Garden from time to time, lawns versus non-lawns, and I think Stefan has indicated there are many reasons why you can have a lawn and need a lawn, and it's a matter of using water wisely to give you to achieve what you want from a lawn without being wasteful.
Stefan Palm, thank you so much for coming into the studio.
My pleasure.
Always great to catch up with Stefan. We're going to catch up with Chris Daniels very shortly and hear about some amazing grassroots grants that are available, and they're there to make sure we have a greener Adelaide in the future.
Yes, a greener and a cooler and a wilder city. That's the vision, and Green Adelaide is the organisation which is putting that together.
This is Weekends with Deb Try.
On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia, Broken Hill.
Good morning and welcome to Talkback Gardening with John Lamb. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Deb. 25 degrees today, blue skies out there, wonderful recipe for good gardening.
It certainly is indeed. And if you've got a gardening question, we'll try and fit you in. 1300 222 891 is the phone number. I have a couple of ABC Gardening Australia magazines to give away this hour, and you're going to be launching the Tomato Survey 2024, John.
Most gardeners have finished their tomato crops for this season, and we want to know, what kind of a crop did you have? Because your information is valuable to help others, particularly next year. So what we're doing is we'll be having our end of tomato season survey, and it'll be appearing in this week's or this Friday's Good Gardening newsletter. So we can announce it and saying, righto, the survey is on. You'll have 2 weekends to actually fill in the form, and then we would like to have those surveys back by about the 8th of April. But we'll give you full of those details. The important thing is that the survey will be in the Good Gardening newsletter, and it's quite extensive. Take you probably more than 5 minutes to do it, but it's tremendously invaluable, because we look at what you've done in terms of when did you plant, what variety did you plant, what kind of management did you carry out, and we can separate the good gardeners from the disappointing gardeners and put one against the other, and that is very revealing in the kind of information that becomes available. It comes back to talkback gardening, and that becomes often a basis for some of the issues that and some of the guests that we invite into talkback gardening to try and overcome the problems.
It certainly does. So if you have had a good season or a bad season, it doesn't matter. I will give you the details of how to take part in Tomato Season Survey 2024 again later in the program. But first up, we are going green, John.
Adelaide is to become a greener and a cooler and a wilder city. And the organisation with the responsibility of making that happen is Green Adelaide. And the essential part of this rather bold program is to make sure that the activities being carried out are being led by the community. And so there's an incentive out there. $1.2 million worth of incentives have just been announced by Green Adelaide. And the chairman of Green Adelaide is Chris Daniels, who of course appears on a regular basis with David Bevan talking environmental issues. So good morning to you, Chris, and thank you very much for making your time on Talkback Gardening.
Oh, good morning, John. Good morning, Deb. And delighted to be here on this beautiful day.
Okay, so let's take a look at what are the kind of activities that you would like to see happen as a result of the grants which are available.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity, John and Deb. The Grassroots Grants are one of our premier programs, and it's a program we're incredibly excited about, and it's delivered some amazing outcomes for Adelaide over the last 3 years or so. So it's one where we offer community groups up to $200,000. Any application can be between $2,000 and $200,000. So largely anything really that's related to cooler, greener, wilder, as you have said. And it can be individuals, it can be streets and community groups, it can be organisations, it can be sporting groups, it can be environmental groups, it can be religious groups. Anybody can apply for one if they've got a really good idea about how to green up the city. And the projects can be sort of almost anything, really. And we've got an enormous diverse range. So they can be from planting up areas. So last year we funded the RSPCA, for example, to develop a food garden to go with their new wildlife hospital down at Glenthorne. And we funded the Marine Discovery Centre to create videos for kids around the marine environment really here locally so that they can better engage with nature. And then we found that streets to do adjust their own particular area and footpaths and so forth. So there's a whole array of projects. And I really don't want to suggest too many because people might go, oh, that's the only the sort of thing you funded. And it isn't. The trick is to go to the website, check out some of the examples there, and then contact the staff and have a good talk about whether your idea is suitable or not.
That's a good idea. If anybody goes to Green Adelaide, their home page, and then click on blogs, you'll find that there are some wonderful examples of what has already been achieved in the past.
Yes, that's exactly right. And use your imagination. Come up with really exciting, preferably a little novel, project that will really catch the community's eye. So what we're trying to do is the sort of thing you do on your project, John and Deb, your program, and that is really engage people with how wonderful nature is and that you can do things to improve your life and the life of others and the life of the wildlife we share our space with right there in your own street, your own backyard, your own community. And it's been incredibly successful, really, really well taken up over the last few years. And we expect lots of applications.
Yes, well, I was thinking about it last night lying in bed and thinking, what kind of an application would I put in? And I'd say, righto, it's a dry city. It's a dry city. And if we want a green city, we need water. So to me, I would say, how can I get water? And then I'd think, righto, it's the outer suburbs that really do need to be made greener. And as part of my role, I get to judge landscapes at the Landscape Association Awards, and you often get taken to the outer suburbs where there's the local council have developed a lovely park was full of grass and a few trees, and just what could be done there? Digging a big hole, filling it with water, bringing in the frogs and planting the plants and bringing in the birds and the butterflies, and the mind goes berserk as to what could happen.
Well, that's exactly what we're looking for. That's absolutely spot on, John, that we can get those sorts of applications. A lot of schools like to do that in their own space as well, because, you know, a huge amount of the footprint of Adelaide is primary and secondary schools, so a tremendous opportunity there. So those are the types of thinking and projects that we're looking for.
There are many community organisations out there, whether it's a school or whether it's a footy club, there's just so many of them. But putting in an application could be a little bit daunting, and I do believe that you've got some assistance there.
Yes, that's right. And we fund, I think, last few years we funded about a third of the applications. So we always encourage people to apply again. Don't be disheartened if you didn't get it last year or the year before. Polish it up and put it in. And yes, we have specialists here to help with the grants. We also have a grant writing workshop on April the 3rd. And for novice applicants, that's a really good thing to attend, because you get to know the nuances and the sorts of things that the assessors will look for. There's technical aspects, there's ideas, abilities to deliver, how you manage the money, all those sorts of things that need to be incorporated into an application.
Chris, so that really sounds invaluable. Where is that happening?
All of the details are on the website. I'm not exactly sure of the location, Deb. I know it's the 3rd of April, so as you click on and you look at the form, that'll tell you exactly where the workshop is happening.
Can I come back to that website? It's brilliant. Whoever's putting that needs to be congratulated, because there's a lot of news what's happening with Green Adelaide, but I think I like are the blogs. And might I say thank you very much for coming on board with the Good Gardening newsletter, so that once a month we'll be featuring one of the blogs maybe that be of particular interest to home gardeners.
Oh, look, thank you for approaching us, John, and we're incredibly excited about partnering with you, because our values are very tightly aligned. You know, getting people outside, enjoying a day like today, whether they're spending it in the natural environment or doing their gardening, growing things, that brings in birds, and you know, we all benefit from that. So it's wonderful to be partnering with you.
Chris, can I just say, on the text line, someone's saying, can you please ask Chris if the grants apply outside the city? Well, obviously, it's Green Adelaide, and at the moment you're looking at the metropolitan area of Adelaide. Are there any plans afoot, are you aware, to try and increase these types of grassroots grants in regional areas?
Yes, all the landscape boards have their own grassroots programs. They're advertised at different times of the year. In fact, I think a number of the other landscape boards, like the Hills and Fleurieu, Northern and York in our area, Kangaroo Island, I think some of those might be open now. You can check on their websites. But yes, these grassroots grants are undertaken by all of the landscape boards across the state. So there's plenty of opportunity wherever you live.
Well, Professor Chris Daniels, thank you very much for making us aware of them. If you are a community group, it doesn't have to be a gardening group. It can be any group at all you'd like to green up. Go online and check out Green Adelaide Grassroots Grants. Chris, thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you, Deb. Thank you, John.
Professor Chris Daniels, Chair of Green Adelaide. And just on the issue of greening Adelaide, Frosty on the text line, which is 0467922891, says you won't green Adelaide with the current planning and development laws. Every time a developer dissects a large urban dwelling, the established trees are the first things to get the chop. Fix this. Thanks for that, Frosty. Let's head now to Leabrook. Jill, you've got a tree growth problem. What sort of tree is it, Jill?
It's what I call a pitosporum, but I think some people call pitiosporum. It's one with the light green leaves. And on the trunk of both of them, there is this growth that looks like lots of little beetly things, but they're not beetles. They don't move. They're round, about a couple of millimetres across, pinkish coloured, and they've got like four little spikes coming out of them, like legs.
Yes, I'm looking at the picture that you sent through to us, Jill, but I don't know if John can see it.
No, yeah. It just looks like a little bit of good old-fashioned lichen. Can you scrape those?
No, it's not lichen.
It's not lichen.
No.
How do you know it's not lichen?
because I know what lichen looks like.
Okay, that's good. Righto, so that these are little growths?
Yeah, and they go right up the tree.
Yes.
I've cut out one of the canopies because it's gone all the way up there and I can't get up that high.
If you get something sharp and you try to dig them out, how deep does it
are they embedded in? No, they're stuck on the surface.
They're just on the surface.
Yeah,
and they are
my
just
fingernail.
And are they growing? That's the size of them, or do they actually sort of keep on growing and become bigger and bigger?
I don't think so. I only noticed it a week ago. I took a picture into the garden shop. They said try some antifungal, but I can see. It's gone right up into the canopy beyond where I can reach.
Yes, and it's only on this particular tree, on nothing else?
Yeah, two trees just next to each other.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
And next to it is a bay tree that's got nothing on it.
Yes. Okay. Is it possible that email can be sent to me?
I don't know that we can do that.
That's all right.
It's unusual. We'll see what we can do, John, if we can send it to you. But I think you've stumped John. He's looking quizzically at the photograph.
Well, there's a growth on it. And I mean, yeah. there are lots of kind of strange growths like lichens. And a lichen is there for a long, long, long time. But there are other things. If you get the right kind of environmental conditions of moisture and temperature, then you'll get a little growth. And I presume it's one of those, but it's atypical. And I'd just like to be able to follow that up and find out for my own edification,
I don't know if you're on email, Jill, but if you're able to email it through to us, please. It's Adelaide Weekends with an S at abc.net.au. If you send it through that way with a photo, I'll make sure it goes on to John.
Yes, and because we've been talking about it, if we can come up with a solution, it's the kind of thing where it'll make a nice little photo for the Good Gardening newsletter with a solution.
So we'll try and follow that one up for you, Jill. Thank you very much for sending that through. Keith's in Hawthorndean with a yellowing tomato plant. Hi, Keith.
Hi, Deb. Hi, John. Look, I just want to... each year, I grow a patch of tomatoes. They're camellos. I stake them in well. They're in well-prepared soil with a lot of compost, etc., that's been put in there. By December, January, I've got healthy plants. I run 2 litres up 6-foot stakes, and they're fruiting, and the plants are really healthy with dark green leaves and lots of well-developed tomatoes up to 2 inches in diameter. But then they start, for some reason... they start to get a yellowing in the leaves. It's a yellowy, bronzy colour. It's not just at the bottom of the stake. It's midway and can be all the way up into the crown. And then those leaves, which are a yellowy, bronze colour, they start to dry off and it actually sort of forces the tomatoes to ripen. What I want to know is this a virus? And the other thing is, I have, in previous years, I've noticed it comes on after a heat wave, even though the tomatoes are well watered. So what I've done is I've introduced shade cloth and to make sure that the plant doesn't get that stress from the, any heatwave weather. But it still happened this year, and it happened after we had a cooler summer. So I'm wondering, what is this yellowing
Interesting,
the tomato leaf?
Yeah, very interesting there, Keith. You sound like you're a pretty keen and a pretty experienced kind of a gardener. So if I said, are you familiar with the damage caused by mites, you'd know what I'm talking about?
Damage caused by mites? I'm familiar with mites on my beans, red spider and mites on my beans. I'm familiar with whitefly.
Right. What you just described to me was the typical damage of red spider mites on the backs of the leaves of your tomatoes. They are the kind of things that they build up during the season, and when we get the plants are a little bit stressed, the mites sort of seem to multiply, and they love hot, dry, dusty conditions, and that's what you're more likely to get towards the end of the growing season. That would give you the leaves, which actually go bronzy, and the yellowing can be part of the program. And if it's severe enough, the fruits also start to become affected. I'd put my money on mites, But
All right, okay. And what would you? What's the prevention? I tend to organically garden and use minimal chemical.
Sure, sulfur is I won't say it's organic, but it's acceptable to me. Wettable sulfur is your best solution, and start using that probably towards once the fruit has ripened and you picked your first wave. I would be making sure that you have given the plants a good dosing of a wettable sulfur and get that into the inside of the canopy if you possibly can. Wettable sulfur, as the sulfur during hot weather, it becomes volatile, and the fumes also are very, very effective, and it continues to work for quite some time. So one spray of a wettable sulfur around about Christmas time might solve your particular problem. Just bear in mind, you don't apply it when the temperature is going to be about 32 degrees or above 32 degrees.
I've used wettable sulfur for other things, and I'm very aware of the whole thing with temperature and that sort of thing.
Okay, right. Well, I mean, there's something that's stressing it. There could be a nutrient deficiency, but from your description, I reckon you're a pretty good gardener. You know how to prepare your soil in terms of getting the nutrition right before you put the seedlings in and things like that. And from your description, it just sounds very much like mites.
Keith, good luck with that. Now, John, in relation to Jill's question about her pittosporum or pittosporum, a couple of suggestions are coming in. Rescale. People saying that they have also got scale on their pittosporum.
Scale is a little like a lid. It's like a protective shell. And what I'm looking at,
they look like
on
little
the
spiders,
screen,
don't they? Yeah, they four-legged look, spiders.
It looks like sort of a mealybug. You know, it's got a central little body, and then there's all these little like legs, white legs coming out, spreading out like just like a.
Like some sort of creature.
It looks like a spider, but it's not. It's certainly not scale.
Thank you very much for your texts. I've got a couple of Gardening Australia magazines to give away. If you haven't won anything from ABC Radio Adelaide in the last month, then call in on 1300 222 891.
Talk Back Gardening with John Lamb and Deb Tribe on ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
We are Talk Back Gardening this morning. Jeff is in Victor Harbour. Now, Jeff, what's the matter with your angel wing, please?
Oh, good morning to you both. It's from the last heat wave, it hasn't been looking very well, and some of the bottom leaves have dried off. I'm wondering if I've given it too much water.
Quite possibly, yeah. They're very sensitive. Now, angel wings, there can be a number of different plants with angel wings. We're talking about a begonia?
Well, it's grey colour. It has leaves like lamb's ears.
Oh, righto. Well, that's not the
that's not the angel wing you're thinking of.
Yeah, the angel wings is a begonia, and it has brilliant red flowers on it with little wings on it that looks like angel. If there was an angel, it had sort of things that made it fly. So
I've had this plant for about 6 to 8 months, and it's been wonderful. And yes, from the last heat wave, it's suffered, and I thought perhaps I've been too much water, or is there something else that could
be wrong? Is it in full sun or in shade?
It has 50% sun every day, and then it's in the shade.
And it gets morning sun and afternoon shade.
Yes, yes. Righto.
I've found it online, John. So it's a succulent from South Africa.
Yes.
And it has got big grey leaves that look like angel's wings.
Oh, how about that? Well, yeah. From your description of what's happening, I would suspect that the ground has been moist and then probably very, very warm. And being South African, it should take hot conditions, but it's the combination of the moisture and the warmth probably has destroyed the root system. And it could well be, Jeff, that beforehand maybe it's been allowed to dry, it's been stressed, or something stressed it, so you've got a root system which is sort of crying out for a little bit of help. It gets watered, it's nice and moist, along comes the sun, and you get hot temperatures, you get root rots, and that's causing that particular problem. The important thing, I think, is to make sure that the soil, the topsoil, is allowed to dry out only for about a centimetre or 2 centimetres at the top, and then when you do water it, give it a deep watering, and then don't water it again for probably a week or maybe until that topsoil dries out again. And with the first watering, give it one of the seaweed products that will help just stimulate the plants and do other things which are valuable.
Thank you, John. That sounds good advice.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. Appreciate it. Congratulations to Lorna in Ross Trevor and Rosemary in Harndorf, who have won the ABC Gardening Australia magazines today. There'll be more next week, so stay tuned for that. Linda is in Torrens Park, and I think, Linda, you're going to be our last talkback gardening call this morning, and you've got a possum problem. Hello.
Oh, yes. Well, possum problems. Where do I start? It's been a very, very bad year for possums around here. They ate all the blossom off my apples, and they've basically decimated everything that's grown. The thing I'm concerned about is I've got a weeping apricot. Now, it's planted right next to a fence, and the possums are obviously coming along the fence, and then they're eating all the leaves that are sort of on the crown of the weeping apricot.
Yes.
And what I'm concerned about is this going to weaken the whole tree? Because, like, it's happening sort
regularly,
of at that point where all the branches come out, and every time a new leaves come, they disappear again. The ends of the branches have plenty of leaves on them and they look okay, but I'm just concerned about whether it's doing damage to the tree.
Yes, if the plants are being attacked on a very regular basis and it's losing its leaves, slowly it will go into decline. The fact that the end growth, most of the what's happening in a plant is in the end growth of the tip growth. And so so long as the tip growth is healthy, you've still got a good chance that the plant will survive. But the problem is there and it's going to continue. And to me, there's only one solution with possums, and that's exclusion. You need to put some form of netting. And because they are there over a long period, you're going to have your netting there probably for 6 months of the year, and it doesn't look very good. It's a major issue, possums, and for those that want a productive garden, what to do, because there are certain restrictions on what you can do to a possum, and it's one that I've discussed with Chris Daniels on a number of occasions, and there is no solution. You can sort of, if it was they're just coming in for a once feed to eat the fruit, by giving them a decor, having some spare fruit somewhere close by, they might eat the fruit rather than yours. But over an extended period, that's not going to work. And exclusion is really the only solution.
And that's a tricky one, Linda, I can tell you. I've actually just been chopping up garlic and putting it in a spray and spraying all around the tree on the basis they don't like that. But look, you know, there are so many remedies. If you go online, you'll find a dozen of them. The question is, as John said, it's very, very hard. I've had the same problem for years.
Yes. Garlic is probably the best. Minced garlic concentrated with a little bit of soapy material. And if you spray that onto the area, the target area, the possums come in, they get garlic on their feet.
They don't like it.
They don't like that. They go home, they lick their feet, and they sort of say, that's not very, very nice. But you've got to be doing that on a pretty regular basis to keep the garlic strong enough to be effective.
That's right. And if you've got a metal fence, it's just not going to work on the long term anyway. And Linda's got the tree right up against the fence. Linda, it's a tough one. I'm really sorry we can't offer you any more help than that. On the text line, other people saying they're having the same problem with possums eating their fruit tree leaves, plum and cherry trees, etc. So lots and lots of people with problems. And I tell you what, we've had so many texts from you this morning. Really appreciate it. A few on tomatoes. Joy says, I planted different types and had a bumper crop this year. Thanks, Joy. Sar from Strath says, that's not on tomatoes. Sorry, Mary of the Barossa says, I was unwell late last year, so I didn't get to organise any veggie garden, but tomatoes have decided they want to take over my back garden almost completely. They took off before I managed to control and stake the early ones so others could be moved. They're small, still green, but when they ripen, I'll have masses of them. And that's what you want to hear, John, don't you?
We want to know, were there more good crops this season than disappointing crops? And if you did have a good crop, what did you do so that it was a good crop? And obviously the season had a big effect, but there are many management issues that we need to tap into. So start thinking about how you've grown your tomatoes, collect your varieties, and that information will turn up as a survey in this Friday's Good Gardening newsletter and the following one, and you'll have 2 weekends to be able to fill it in, and then it gets put into the little mincing machine with wonderful answers coming back, and we'll have those answers coming back via Talkback Gardening, of course.
Wonderful. So stay tuned. Grab your gardening notes if you've been making them for this tomato season, and that will land next Friday morning, John, in our inbox.
Absolutely, yes, and I think it's a good weekend for repotting and planting seedlings and doing lots of things in the garden. Until next week, I'll say good gardening.